good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Thursday, February the 22nd, 2018, 14 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program. We want to thank Joe Negri for coming on last hour. Of course, you probably remember him best as Handyman Negri on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, which debuted February 19th, 1968, 50 years ago. This past Monday, and we all know the big motion picture feature with Tom Hanks will be coming out next year. So we thank David Newell, Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood for coming on yesterday, and Joe Negri today, the last two castmates who I think are still in the Pittsburgh area of that great public television series. Now, this hour, we have a first-time visitor to this program, and I'm excited about this because this gentleman certainly knows something about the world of politics. His family goes back into the 1800s. His grandfather was a vice president of the United States under Grover Cleveland, an Ohio tie. His father, you probably all remember, as being the presidential nominee two times in the 1950s against Dwight Eisenhower, the Democratic nominee for president, and worked with the United Nations during the Cuban Missile Crisis under President Kennedy. He, our guest today, has been involved in politics in Illinois and was once thought of as being a presidential nominee and a vice presidential candidate. We'll learn about all that. So proud to welcome to this microphone a man with great name lineage, Adlai Stevenson III. Mr. Stevenson, how are you?
Surviving. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to speak with you. I have to ask right off the bat, what do you make of all the... what do you make of our president? Let's just start right there.
Oh. Well, I'm afraid he's a dangerous symptom of a dysfunctional politics. He's impulsive. Of course, he's had no experience to qualify him for the presidency. Unpredictable. And you don't know what's going to happen next. But in the meantime, he's doing the country's security and its reputation in the world considerable damage. But giving us all as citizens an opportunity to repair our politics. And I said symptom because, at least in Illinois, but I think throughout the country, there are many symptoms of dysfunctionality in our democracy. Democracy is, by its nature, fragile.
Last night, I don't know if you had a chance to watch it or not, but I watched the town hall on CNN with the kids from Florida. From the school shooting last week, and talking to Marco Rubio and the senators and the congressmen from Florida. Do you think anything's going to change as far as gun laws go in this country, and should it change?
Well, I did not see the program, but obviously things need to change, and they have in all other democracies. They all have far lower levels of violent crime, gun-related crime, and they all have strict gun control laws. But this gets back again to the dysfunctionality, the corruption in our politics. We don't have the courage, the integrity with which to do what every other democracy does. In other words, if you don't ban handguns, those are the real crime guns. You at least register the guns and the gun owners, have background checks for owners of long guns, etc. There are lots of ways to do it, and every other country does do it. They all have lower rates of violent crime. It's just another symptom of what's wrong. You're up against the National Rifle Association. I ran six times, you know, statewide in Illinois. I was a gun owner. I'm a Marine Corps veteran of Korea. I shot sharpshooter in the Marines. I'm a hunter. And I take on the NRA, take them head on, and beat them. But who has the courage to do that? And, of course, our whole politics has changed. Money is far more influential today in our politics than it was during my many years in service.
You know, Mr. Stevenson, I was looking last night, and during this debate, there was a moment where one of the students asked Senator Marco Rubio if he would stop taking money from the NRA. And Senator Rubio's response was he would not stop, but that money coming in does not dictate his policy. Do you think that's a true statement?
I wonder why that money is going to Marco Rubio if it's not influencing him. It's not going into him because he's opposing the NRA, that's for sure. I must say, I never had any difficulty opposing money from the NRA, or rejecting it, I should say. It wasn't there.
It was an interesting time. I want to talk about your life, because what an interesting lineage your family has. Growing up, the son of Adlai Stevenson II, you know, certainly well-known here in the United States without question. What was your upbringing like?
What was my what?
What was your childhood like?
First, God, let me say it goes back, this family goes back five generations to Jesse Fell, a Republican who persuaded Lincoln to run for president. He proposed the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Lincoln gave him his sublime autobiographical sketch. It was in the form of a letter, which Jesse Fell then used to promote Lincoln's candidacy for the presidency. Jesse Fell was secretary of the Republican Party back in the 1860s. So we've been engaged for a long time, and as my father said of himself, he was born with an incurable hereditary case of politics. And I guess that was my problem. I never had a chance, but I tried to follow in the family tradition, working my way up, starting in the legislature, Illinois legislature, then as state treasurer, then as United States Senator for two terms, and twice as a Democratic candidate for governor of Illinois.
What was it like growing up with your father involved?
Well, you know, he died early. He died in 1965. And he was always an inspiration to me. But, you know, he was always on assignments in Washington during the early New Deal deal days, during the Second World War. We traveled some together. He loved traveling all around the world, learning about the world from on the ground. And he'd take his kids, you know, with him so that they could see the world from within it and as it really was. But he never lectured me. He never, you know, tried to tell me to go into politics or do this or that. He just set an example. And then he died very prematurely at the age of 65. And he lived just long enough to see me get elected to my first office, the Illinois legislature, in an at-large election. He was an inspiration, but when we, you know, got together, it was that which wasn't often because I was away at school or in the Marine Corps, or, you know, somewhere traveling. It usually had to focus on family matters, you know, on running the farm and family. You're always traveling, always moving around. But he was always an inspiration. He trusted the people with the truth. He told it no matter how unpopular. In his campaigns for the Hebrew, first of all, he reformed state government and then went on to be drafted. He didn't want to run for president in 1952. He was drafted. Boy, has our politics changed since then. He was drafted by a convention of politicians. And in those two campaigns, which were hopeless, running against the popular Dwight D. Eisenhower, he laid out the programmatic foundation for the New Frontier and the Great Society, which followed. In his New America, he began the strategic arms control process. He exemplified a totally different politics in which winning wasn't everything. Service was everything. Trust the people with the truth, all the truth. Trust in their good sense and their decency, and he did.
He had these two runs as president against Dwight Eisenhower in the 1950s. You were in your 20s. What do you remember about those campaigns, those conventions? Did he ever speak of those?
Well, you see, I was in the Marine Corps during the 52 convention. My first Democratic convention was in 1948 in Philadelphia. And I remember it vividly. I was a sergeant-at-arms. That was that was security in those days. And stationed beneath the rostrum in that smoke-filled, sweaty room full of politicians. I remember vividly my future Senate seatmate, an unknown mayor of Minneapolis, got recognition and demand of those politicians that they do their duty. They adopt a strong civil rights plank. And they rose up and did their duty. And in doing so, they drove the South out of the Democratic Party. It was a hopeless year. But back in Illinois, those politicians gathered behind closed doors and nominated a former bureaucrat, a diplomat, unknown, no base in Illinois, for governor. His name was Adlai Stevenson II. And for the United States Senate, a reformer, a professor of economics at the University of Chicago, Paul Douglas, for the United States Senate. And against all the odds, they went on to win. In fact, my father won by the largest plurality in the history of the state. And you know how much his election cost?
How much?
$347,000. Mm. We went from factory gate to factory gate. I was the driver in that campaign. Factory gate, ward committee meetings in Cook County, Chicago, at night, county squares, and so on, pressing the flesh. Hand to hand, person to person, while laying out, you know, the program. Then he was renominated in 56, continued developing his New America, his agenda for the country, and of course was defeated by Eisenhower. But in those failed campaigns for president, he succeeded. He may have been done more to influence policy than Eisenhower. The frontier, the new frontier, the Great Society, the war on poverty, they all followed in the strategic arms control process. Today, I don't think he'd be possible. Trump is possible.
During this time, in his early political days, Truman is around, FDR is around, Eisenhower is around. Did you meet any of these people?
Oh, yeah, I met him. I never met Eisenhower, but I certainly met Truman, Johnson. Can't remember who else you met.
Roosevelt?
What?
Roosevelt?
No, that was too early for me, but I remember hearing him once because we were living in Washington during the New Deal. I remember hearing him make a speech. No, I was too young.
We hear so much about Truman, yet not a lot of video and radio because there just wasn't a whole lot when he was president. How would you describe Harry Truman in your meetings with him?
Well, I think he grew in the, you know, in the office. He wasn't prepared for it, but he became a very, you know, a good president. He basically continued the policies of FDR. So I'm not quite sure how he got elected. It was probably for political reasons. And he was, really wasn't prepared by FDR to become president. But I think he was a good president. Strange. Candidates in those days all had agendas: New Deal, Fair Deal, Great Society, etc. New America of my father. When did one last have an agenda? Where's the New Deal? I think the 70s was a kind of a transitional decade. Politics became more and more visual, episodic. Television took over, and of course it cost money, so the money began to pour in. And I noticed the changes in the Senate towards the end. In the Senate that I remember, there was no partisanship, zero partisanship. We divide, of course, but not along partisan lines. Might have been North versus South, more likely conservative versus liberal, with many, if not most, of the conservatives being Southern Democrats, but never did we divide along partisan lines. Now look at the Congress. It's just gridlocked. It's as if serving in Congress is for one purpose, power, instead of service. And the money pours in. So they respond to their givers, including the NRA.
You know, Mr.
That just was the case. I never spent more than $1 million in 6 statewide runs.
That's amazing to think of in today's terms. There's another couple things here I wanted to touch on in your father's life, because I think it's fascinating that he was drafted as president in 52, ran again in 56. Now in 60, you were 30 years old. The Democrats had a chance to win this one. Eisenhower was on his way out. Nixon was not particularly a great candidate at that point. He did run in the Democratic primary, supported by Eleanor Roosevelt. People forget that. What do you think happened with he and Kennedy? Being 30 years old, how much were you a part of that situation?
I was involved that year. My father, you know, did not... He was the so-called titular leader of the party. That, too, has disappeared. I don't remember him running in primaries in 1960. I do remember a groundswell of support that swept across the country to that convention. I think it was in San Francisco, where I was president. I can remember Jack Kennedy coming to our home, soliciting my father's support, but he felt as titular leader of the party, he had to stay neutral. He indirectly offered my father the position of Secretary of State in exchange for his support. And father felt that it was his duty to be neutral. I remember in San Francisco, Eleanor Roosevelt that was there, and this groundswell, people literally beat down the doors. Gene McCarthy of the convention flooded the convention. Gene McCarthy made an impassioned speech nominating Stevenson. And I can remember the night before the balloting, it was Willard Wirtz, later Secretary of Labor, told me that my father told him, when Bobby calls, tell him I've gone to bed and left instructions not to be bothered. And sure enough, Bobby calls. And Bill Wirtz picks up the phone and explains that the governor isn't taking any calls. And Bobby says, well, you tell him this is his last chance. And so Father Emmert later he went all out for support of Jack Kennedy, campaigned all across the country for him. And then when it was all over, he was offered the position of U.S. Representative at the United Nations, and he was stunned. I remember him saying, if I was qualified to be Secretary of State in April, why wasn't I qualified in November? And he refused to accept at first. Said, I want to know who my boss is, who the Secretary of State is going to be. And of course, he finally did accept, and he served brilliantly there, and he died there. I think that position killed him. Mm. He took all of the post responsibilities of the office seriously, and at times had to support policies, as in Vietnam, that he didn't support, and died.
There are some people
he was planning to resign. He never would have resigned in protest. He just would have quietly slipped away.
There's a few things I want to go back here and pick up. So much written about Jack Kennedy. What was he like? What was your impression of Jack Kennedy, the man?
Oh, we were fans of Jack Kennedy. I can remember, what year was it? 1956, I guess. When Kennedy was the contender for vice president at the convention in Chicago, my family, were all rooting for Jack Kennedy. But because the nomination for president was not in doubt, my father decided to try to stir up some, excitement by opening the nomination for vice president, creating a contest between Jack Kennedy and Estes Kefauver. And the balloting just sort of went back and forth. And at one point, when Kennedy was up, I raced downstairs at the Stockyards and burst into his room as he was pulling up his trousers to go down to the floor, and congratulated him on his nomination for vice president of the United States, and raced back upstairs just in time to see the nomination for vice president won by Estes Kefauver. No, we were real real fans of Jack Kennedy and his sainted wife.
The other person who was a gigantic fan of your father's campaign, probably his biggest campaigner, most people would say, Eleanor Roosevelt. What was she like?
Oh, God, there aren't words to describe that noble woman. He had, I don't know where he first met. It could have gone, you know, back to New Deal days, but they served together at the conference in San Francisco, which laid the foundation for the, you know, created the United Nations. And I don't know, she was a large part of his life, an advisor. He consulted her. He delivered the eulogy finally at her, you know, funeral ceremony. I remember him saying she would rather light a candle than curse the darkness. A really creative, brilliant, and totally principled a woman.
You know, a lot of people, and you having known her might have a good answer for this, see her in her time as a bit of a complicated woman, much like Hillary Clinton. People see her as complicated in that certainly she knew that her husband had affairs. She didn't have the best relationship with her kids. Ended up living with Dr. Gradyevich in New York in her later years. She did like Stevenson. Came to like Kennedy, I think. Wrote newspaper columns. Was she an easy person to know? Was she a likable person?
Well, you know, I didn't know her that well. I remember likable isn't quite the right word. She was somebody you couldn't help but respect. I remember her driving her in from our home in the Chicago suburbs to, I guess, the airport. And it was as if she was asleep, and yet I could tell she was listening. She had trained herself to rest, sleep, but while staying alert. So I didn't communicate with her. She just listened. And so I never really got to know her personally. Likeable doesn't quite fit. She was too, and I don't see anything similar between her and Hillary. Eleanor was totally principled. She was not a pragmatist, and she was wise. And yes, had all kinds of complex family situations that I don't, you know about or understand. But I feel I really do know that person. And I do not know Hillary, but I don't detect many similarities.
One thing I want to touch on before we get to your runs here. Some people say your father's finest hour was during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the speech at the United Nations. Do you have any memories of that?
Well, I guess we all do. I don't think it's his finest hour. He was being himself. You know, he'd been sort of isolated from the White House by the Irish Mafia, led by Bobby, and when it came to presenting the evidence, he presented the evidence. He was being himself. I remember remember, was it, he asked the Russian ambassador for a response, and he ended up saying, and the Russian ambassador, you'll get your response in good time, and he said, I'll wait till hell freezes over for your response. he was being Adlai Stevenson, and it was not surprising to me, but it came to a relief to some of those in the White House who always distrusted him. They thought he was a rival, and he wasn't. He was better than they were.
Interestingly enough, he sees you get your first elected position. Unfortunately, he passes away. In the 70s, when politics is changing, as you say, you are thought of as a candidate in 76 against Gerald Ford. Why did that not take place?
Oh, let's see, all these years, 76, Richard J. Daley, the legendary boss of Chicago, urged me to run for president. I thought about it. In some ways I regret, but I decided I wasn't ready. In retrospect, I was relatively ready. But I ended up as one of the five finalists for vice president. And I can remember now Jimmy Carter calling me early one morning and saying he'd selected somebody else, and I was relieved. He had selected my Senate seatmate and good friend, Walter Mondale. It was a good choice, better choice. And, that was the last of it. I decided to escape the Senate in 1981 and take a breather. Been in office for 16 years. And then decided to run for the office I had most wanted, and that was governor. And that begins another story.
What happens in that governor's race?
Well, I had I was, among other things, chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on the Collection and Production of Intelligence. And after the Likud came to power in, 1976, and began its aggressive settlements policy, I began the first in-depth U.S. study of terrorism, which ended with the warnings of acts of disruption and destruction and a terrorist scene, and don't think it can't happen here. And the Comprehensive Anti-Terrorism Act of 1977, and then a companion measure which reduced spending U.S. Aid for Israel by $200 million until such time as the President of the United States could certify that Israel's settlements policy was consistent with U.S. policy. Well, I didn't expect to win. I was going to make a point that given a choice between supporting the U.S. and peace in the Middle East or supporting the Israeli lobby, the lobby as it's known, the Congress would support the latter. Well, I made the point. I got 11 votes, 7 votes. One senator from North Dakota, matter-of-factly, came up and said, Adlai, I'm sorry, but I'm up for re-election. Well, when I ran for governor, the lobby came after me hammer and tong. They dried up sources of funds, scared off, many supporters, though prominent American Jews who were totally with me. Like Phil Kutznick, former ambassador, former secretary of commerce, former president of the World Council of the Jewry, were behind me by 100%, but that money dried up. And then we ended with, much to everybody's amazement, contrary to the polls, ended up with a tied, a virtually tied election. I was down officially about 1/7 of 1%, but we had poll watchers all over the state, and we could see what was happening. In one county, for example, we could see the officials, a big Republican suburban county, punching out the punch cards, just voting for the people. So we had proof that I had won, and we presented it to the Illinois Supreme Court, which told the clock until 2 days before the inauguration, and then ruled by one corrupt vote that we were denied a recount. And I say that corrupt vote advisedly. That was a Democratic justice who crossed over and voted with the Republicans and acknowledged to a mutual friend that he had done it because of, quote, Israel. And I was a friend of Israel. I'd even authored the Arab Anti-Boycott Act, which prohibited U.S. companies from participating in the boycott, the Arab boycott of Israel. but I tried again and for governor, 86, this was the 82 election. And in 86, I was going to win by a landslide. But party organization had broken down, and a member of the Lyndon LaRouche anti-Semitic cult was nominated for vice president over my candidate, George Sangmeister, an admired, very skillful senior state senator, and well-qualified. So I had to, I couldn't, I just run for governor and bring that anti-Semite within the proverbial heartbeat of the governorship, so I had to organize a third party, the Solidarity Party, and run as its candidate for governor with the support of the regular Democratic organization. And even in that impossible situation, and with no money to speak of, I won 40% of the vote. Our party, our politics was breaking down. Party organization was breaking down. The Adlai Stevenson Center on Democracy has adopted a very ambitious agenda for political reform, which attempts to address the dysfunctionality in our politics, and at all levels and in all branches of government. The, you know, problems that we've addressed, including election of state judges, are you know, addressed in this very ambitious agenda for political reform. If anybody's interested, they can find it at the website of the Stevenson Center, StevensonCenterOnDemocracy.org. We're now organizing a nationwide coalition of reform organizations and reformers, and they're piling on to support and continue refining this very, very ambitious agenda for political reform. Address all of our dysfunctionalities, from campaign finance to gerrymandering, to reforming the Congress, the Electoral College, the selection of state judges, the organization, reorganization of state and local government, you name it.
Hmm. It's all very interesting. A name you mentioned there, a man who's very remembered in politics, Richard Daley. What kind of guy was he?
Richard J. Daley?
Yes.
Well, I'm a fan of Richard J. Daley. He was appointed director of the Department of Revenue by my father. He'd been, as I recall, a state senator, and my father made him director of revenue, where he was, he served very creditably. He was an excellent mayor of Chicago. He supported strong, you know, qualified candidates for public office, for state and county office. And he was the boss, but meticulous in some ways. I'd go to his city hall office and, you know, to talk state business. But as soon as it turned to politics, he would move across the street to the offices of the Cook County Regular Democratic Organization. He didn't feel it was proper to discuss politics in the office of the mayor. So we went over to speak politics in the office of the Cook County chairman. Very unusual guy, totally honest, and, you know, vilified as the boss, which he was, but he was a good boss and a good mayor.
1968 convention, the riots. Do you have any memories of that?
Of the which, the 68 convention?
Yeah.
God, I can't even remember which one that was now. Who got nominated then?
Humphrey. Kennedy had just been assassinated, Bobby Kennedy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, boy. They all sort of merged together. No, I don't have any memories of the 68 convention. I think it was pretty open and shut, as I recall.
With about 3.5 minutes left, what do you make of this story of Russian meddling?
Well, I'm, you know, offended but not surprised. I don't know the facts. I think there's a good man, Mueller, in charge of the investigation, and in time, we will know, you know, the facts. I don't see any evidence so far of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. And as for meddling goes, well, we're the experts. As I mentioned, I think earlier, I served on the Intelligence Committee and was an overseer for the NSA and for the CIA. But that was before social media, before, you know, the Internet. And we meddled at the innocent level by just bribing foreign correspondents. But meddle? That wasn't what we did. What happened to the elected president of Iran? He was overthrown by the United States. What happened to Patrice Lumumba in Congo? What happened to Salvador Allende in Chile? No, we didn't meddle. We just overthrew them. So I think there ought to be a little perspective here, and as to what we are doing in what in Russia, I don't know. I'm no longer the overseer, and even if I were the overseer, I wouldn't know what I didn't see. Oversight in the Congress is very difficult, but I would be very surprised if we weren't, quote, meddling in Russian politics. That's what the CIA does, and it's not confined to Russia.
The name Adlai Stevenson applies to three different people who were very prominent in politics. When people hear that name, what do you hope they think of?
When they hear what name?
Adlai Stevenson.
Integrity. And when I'm referring to my father, total integrity and, you know, wisdom. And a man, unfortunately, of the past, but a reminder of what our politics can be. And if the Adlai Stevenson Center on Democracy succeeds, we will recall at least some of the politics which he exemplified in his life. Trump, in a way, this dysfunction is giving us an opportunity. Our politics, our democracy can rebound. It's a challenge, but as Alan Toynbee in his study of history writes, nations rise and fall according to their ability to respond to challenge. We have a great opportunity here, and the Stevenson Center is leading the response with many partners. They're rising up across the country, so much good could come of this dysfunction.
It's very interesting. This has been a fascinating hour. Adlai Stevenson III, thank you so much for coming on, and I hope we can do it again in the future.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's it for this day. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Bye.
To Emmy Award-winning star of Picket Fences, Five-ish Finkel.
Oh, you're